The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. Today, I'm delighted to say I've been joined by the founder and CEO of Escape to Make, a woman who did not enjoy school, but thanks to an inspirational art teacher, was encouraged to find her passion. She did an art foundation course, studied textiles, worked in the entertainment, technology, property and design industries, and then became a social entrepreneur. Now, she only works on projects that make a difference. Thus, her setting up E2M, which aims to help all 11 to 18-year-olds in her region escape boredom, social media, loneliness, and pressure at school by providing free workshops and short courses. Welcome to the Inspired Minds podcast, Jenny Natouche.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on board. Now we start the Inspired Minds podcast every time with the question about inspiration. What it means to you? What is it? How do you derive it? How important do you think it is?
Well, I think it's very important. And I think to have inspiration in the first place, for me, it's all about connection, really feeling connected to your authentic self and feeling connected. I think there's something about being connected to your community. So you get that sense of belonging and purpose. And then being connected to the environment as well is very important. So if you have all those things together, then you're really in a very good place, I think.
Is it important to you? Because I know you've had a lot of different lives. You know, you've written for TV, made lots of things. You started the charity, which we'll talk about later. But there's a period of your life which is sort of glossed over in your biography. Was that a sort of inspiration-free period when you were doing a proper job, as people might say?
Yes, I did have a proper job once, and you're right, I did gloss over that bit. That was the period of my life when I was the co-founder of a business in the property technology sector, and I got pretty close to sort of burning out with it all. And that chapter came just after a time when I'd been truly inspired, inventing formats for TV programs. Long story. I was on the dole in London and I didn't really have a clue about television as I hadn't been brought up with it and I didn't even have one. However, by some miracle, I got an idea commissioned and spent a couple of years travelling with the BBC, filming in jungles and deserts and remote locations all over the world. So to go from that to the proper job was quite a rude shock, I suppose. And as a creative in the property tech sector, I felt like a square peg in a round hole and a bit lost, and I had the worst imposter syndrome ever. However, it was a very important chapter and I'm extremely grateful for it because I worked crazily hard and I was able to sell the business, which then helped to put me in a position where I was able to take stock and really start to consider where my passions were and try to figure out how to do something more fulfilling going forward and aligned with my talents and maybe even put back a bit and do some good in the world. But I didn't really know when that would be and what would that look like. And I just had a sense it would happen in its own good time.
What do you consider to be doing good in the world?
Well, I always had a pull to work with children and young people, but maybe because I had some tricky times myself when I was little, or maybe it was because I worked in an orphanage in Thailand when I was at art college in the 90s. And it was a project to help me with my dissertation. And I was studying how children drew when they'd never had the chance to draw before and when they're not conditioned by anything, which ended up being a truly heart-wrenchingly awful experience. But at the same time, very inspiring and joyful and fulfilling to see the delight in their faces as they kind of just lost themselves in drawing for the very first time.
The key here, I guess, is to understand authenticity, because authenticity really matters to you. And it seems that a lot of authenticity in your mind is derived from creativity, because creativity is such a personal thing, isn't it? That each individual is then authentic in what it is that they create. And for you, creativity is absolutely key and fundamental to sort of mental well-being. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think it is, because I think when you're doing something creative, when you're totally absorbed by something, you're in your element. So Ken Robinson wrote a brilliant book, actually. I think it was called In Your Element, and it was about exactly this. And it was about when you're doing something creative, you enter this kind of state of flow. And when you're in that state of flow, time passes and wonderful things happen, and you can be truly creative and connect with yourself. And then that's the magic place. And that's where I think we all need to know how to get there. And a lot of us forget it as we grow up, and we have to keep going back. And that's why I'm really interested in children and young people, because they haven't been so affected and conditioned yet by life. And they're so creative and so imaginative. And I think we can learn a lot from that. I think it's really important.
Escape to Make is, it seems to me, that's its fundamental core set of values, isn't it? It's empowering young people to use their creativity. I mean, give us a sort of idea of the sort of programs for people who don't know what Escape to Make is.
Well, our programs are designed to help all 11s to 18s from anywhere and everywhere to escape from whatever they're struggling with. And that really varies. It could be anything from social media addiction to boredom or loneliness or something much more serious. And it helps them to make things, make friends, and make a difference. So we run clubs throughout the year, for example, architecture, yoga, green skills, film, press, bicycle repair, and craft and textiles. And then we also run 5-week creative programs that feed into community events that they produce, such as cabarets and green festivals and heritage markets. And they design it all as well, because there's no point a load of 40, 50-year-olds deciding what teenagers want, because that would be really arrogant. We're really not in touch with what they want. So we need to ask them. So we have a youth board who design everything we do and how we do it. And the reason it came about is because, well, my daughter wasn't very well. She was 13 years old, that tricky age. I think there's a lot of teenagers struggle about that age. And it's probably when that ego kicks in, actually, and you're losing touch with your authentic self. And because there's not very much creativity in the school curriculum, in secondary education, they don't have that opportunity to get into that state of flow and to really, truly express themselves. And I was finding all this beautiful poetry and beautiful things that she'd made in her bin and thinking, oh, she needs to do some art lessons or poetry lessons or something. And she was struggling more and more. So I went off thinking, I'll find loads of her to do. I'm a good researcher. And I went off and I did a sort of accidental mapping exercise, as I now know it's called. And I came back thinking, oh, she'll say, Mum, I'll do that on a Monday, that on a Tuesday, that on a Wednesday. But the reality was, I found there was so little for 11s to 18s to do. It's almost like society has this blind spot to 11s to 18s, that I saw this brilliant quote, and it said, they're too old for the playground, too young for the pub, and too broke for the cafe. And you know, where do they go? And people say, look at them hanging out in the streets up to no good. Well, of course they are. When society's not offering them an alternative. Anyway, when I realised that there was this big gap, this big void, especially when it comes to creativity. Sporty kids were a lot luckier. If you're sporty, you can generally find something you can join in with. But if you're more creative, it is tricky. Now, because I was working within the creative community, I was able to sort of ask my creative friends, you know, do you know what's going on? And they said, don't think there is anything just for 11s to 18s, but I could do a paint rave, or I could do clock making, or coming up with these brilliant ideas. And then one day I went to buy a loaf of bread from the baker's shop with no plan in my head, no plan at all. I don't know where it came from. Well, I do know where it came from. It was seeing this baker woman who was in her element, baking her bread, making pizzas, putting them in the oven, happy as can be. And I just had this vision of teenagers working with her. So the question came from nowhere. And I said, would you do workshops with teenagers? And she said, absolutely. I'm worried for my little ones when they grow up, what they're going to do. And I'm all about grassroots community things. And have you tried next door? Because there's an ice cream making shop. And I went next door with no plan in my head. And I said, you wouldn't do workshops with teenagers. And they said, absolutely, with both DBS checked. And then within 45 minutes, I'd spoken to the lady on the Indian cookery stall at the market. I'd spoken to the body shop and Lush and the hairdressers. And I realized everybody wants to do this. So here we have this really serious global problem. But then there's this really local, playful solution. So yeah, our workshops are working with these artists and working with these local businesses and simply putting them together. So what we've sort of accidentally done, we've created this model where we think we're now the biggest employer of artists in Lancaster and Morecambe, as well as this being this beautiful solution that is helping so many young people. And they turn up and they've tried CAMS and they've, you know, some of them got serious mental health problems and some of them are absolutely fine. And they turn up and we say, well, we're not school teachers. We're not mental health workers. We're just a bunch of artists. We safeguard it all very well, obviously. And we get astonishing results, so much so that the NHS are now sort of referring to us frequently.
Do you feel that there's more urgent requirement for that to be made through the charitable sector now than there used to be? I mean, I think back to when I was at school and I had a very fortunate upbringing. My school had film clubs, international development clubs, art clubs. Every single gamut of creativity was catered for in some way. It was slightly more didactic because there was probably a teacher that ran each club, and what you're describing is something that's a bit more youth driven. But it feels to me that there's a more urgent requirement for it now than there used to be. And I can't quite put my finger on why that is. You being much closer to it will have a different perspective.
Yeah, well, I think you and I were probably lucky and very privileged in that way that there were more things going on in our schools. There's certainly a lot less in a lot of schools now. A lot of creativity has been cut out of the curriculum. And there is this huge cut in open access youth provision. So over 940 youth centres have closed in the last 10, 12 years. I think it's much more than that now. Funding has been cut by more than 70%. So that's a problem. But then I think there are other problems as well. And I think social media, obviously, is just heightening young people's problems. It's amplifying it like you wouldn't believe. And of course it's going to, because what are they doing? It's isolating them. They're not really having the chance to daydream and be bored and connect with their authentic self. Instead, they're just constantly scrolling. And what are they looking at? They're looking at pictures, mostly of other young people, and comparing themselves and thinking, oh no, I'm not popular enough. I'm not rich enough. I'm not thin enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not muscly enough, whatever it is, and feeling not enough. And that feeling not enough is what is under most adolescent. It's under almost every psychological problem, that feeling of I'm not good enough. I'm not enough. So I think social media has a lot to answer for. And then, of course, if you do then start feeling wobbly, then the algorithms find you and suddenly you know that you're in a very dark echo chamber. And then you're thinking, well, I'm not self-harming enough. I'm not anorexic enough. And it's a very dangerous echo chamber to be in, because you start swapping tips and then suddenly these things are almost glamorized and normalized. And so we need an antidote. And they're so addictive as well. This scrolling is so addictive. So it's like, how do you get a young person to put their phone down? This is a big, big problem in society. And we believe at Escape to Make, one way to do that is to offer them irresistible analog opportunities. Then they'll put their phone down. And then they'll come and they'll do a paint rave, or they'll graffiti Morecambe Beach with rakes and fly drones overhead to film what they've made and show it in a cabaret in Morecambe, so they feel 10 foot high and full of pride, and they now feel like they've got purpose and belonging. They did something good for their community and they had a whole load of fun at the same time. the model of youth provision has to change now. You know, a bit of table football isn't going to cut the mustard. We need to be really, really thinking outside the box to come up with really highly creative solutions to compete with social media. But another problem, if you were at a great school and you were going to all these film clubs and everything within your own school, then the problem you've got there is that you're not actually meeting people from all walks of life, and you end up in a different kind of echo chamber, which can be dangerous in a different way, because you're not sharing perspectives and you're not really learning about each other's cultures and backgrounds. And so that's what we do at Escape to Mate. I have four teenagers, and I remember them saying, if we wanted to meet anybody from the refugee community, for instance, how would we do that? And I was like, don't know. And they said, if we wanted to meet anybody from a different school, how would we do that? Other than a sports match, which is like competitive then, how do you meet them in a friendly way? You know, so what we do, what Escape to Mate does, is we bring them, we have this model where we bring them from all walks of life, and they 25 different schools in the area that we work in, which is Lancaster and Morecambe, but also the residential care homes. Young people there that have never, ever met young people from mainstream education before. And young people who are neurodiverse, who have dropped out of education altogether. And there's more and more of those, especially since COVID, that are avoiding school, emotionally based school avoidance. So we sort of bring them from all walks of life and all backgrounds, and we bring them together, and they're united by this positive common denominator, which might be ice cream making, or it might be zine making, or it might be architecture or engineering or anything to do with making, which encompasses such a lot. So they're brought together not because they're living in a deprived area, or because they've got suicidal ideation, or they've got an addiction problem. They're brought together for a positive reason. And then they're like, wow, they can swap ideas. I just love going to the Escape to Mate workshops and just seeing like how eclectic a group we've brought together, and then hearing them share ideas and share perspectives. I mean, is this not one way to build the culture of compassion that we need, that society needs? Because we need something as the antidote to these echo chambers that the algorithms are throwing us into.
It's a curious paradox, isn't it, really, that social media and the internet was sort of, we thought when it first began, was going to open our minds to other people, take us into places that we otherwise wouldn't go, take us out of our narrow schools, our narrow verticals of class and gender, as a lot of schools that were around when I was a kid were all about, really. But in actual fact, what you're describing is that social media has done the opposite. It's narrowed focus, and by sort of stunting creativity and making the focus on what somebody looks like and comparing with somebody else, we lose a fundamentally important part of our soul. And I'm going to take you right back to what you said near the beginning of that, which was about daydreaming. Because daydreaming to me, daydreaming is a vital thing for me. I spent years in a proper job where I'd forgotten to daydream. But I remembered as a child, I used to daydream every morning. I used to have cooked breakfast every morning, and I used to replay the Second World War. And the way it worked was that the toast or fried bread was Germany. It invaded the egg, which was basically mainland Europe. And then the bacon, which was the Allies, but mostly focused on the British because I was young and idiotically patriotic at the time, would come in and sort out the mess. And whatever was left had won the war. And it would always be one last bit of bacon. And then I'd kind of forgotten to do that until I was in a hotel once and I had a buffet breakfast. And I suddenly realized that the tomatoes could be Italy, the mushrooms could be the French Foreign Resistance, the hash browns were America, the baked beans were the Japanese. I had a whole new world, aged about 35, when I was gazing at my breakfast, and I could make it much more layered. I could have like the Battle of Midway could be happening. It wouldn't just be a theater of war, wouldn't just be in Europe. And I'd kind of forgotten to daydream, I think, for about 20 years. And off the back of that, it sort of kickstarted a whole new working world for me. Daydreaming, you have talked about as sort of fundamental. And it's a fundamentally childish thing to do, but it's something you can keep doing, isn't it, for your entire life?
Definitely. But first of all, can I just say, Dan, what an amazing daydream. I'm not sure I've heard anyone have so much fun with their breakfast. And you were really playing too. And I think that's another thing that us adults just don't do enough of. Was it Einstein that said, play is the highest form of research? So yeah, I think to be able to daydream, you need to be relaxed. You need to let your mind wander, maybe gaze at something for a long time, really let those thoughts get going. But daydream is a form of escaping, isn't it? And zoning out can really take you to a very productive, inspirational place, I think. I think it's the perfect conditions for problem solving, for regulating your emotions and having marvellous ideas, as you clearly did with your bacon and egg. But to answer your question, maybe it's not that we forget how to do it as we get older. Maybe it's just that we don't allow ourselves the chance to be bored enough anymore, you know, to really get to that zoning out place, because we're always on, aren't we? Our telly's always on and our phones and our laptops are always on, and we're living in this world of information overload and constant demands on our attention, and it's just so hard to find the time to be bored. But I reckon zoning out and having a marvellous daydream is far more interesting and nourishing and productive than any amount of scrolling. I used to be in trouble a lot for daydreaming when I was little, when I was at school. You know, I was a horror when I was a teenager, and I was always in trouble. Daydreaming was one of the things I was in trouble for. I was also pretty horrible and naughty, and became the class clown because I had to, because I'd missed half the lesson because I was daydreaming out window. The problem is that if the teaching style doesn't fit your learning style, then you do daydream and you drift off and you get in trouble for that. I now know I've got ADHD, which is just a label. I know it's just a label. Maybe it's a label for just being really creative and not having a teacher that can connect with you. Yeah, daydreaming is really underrated for grown-ups.
It is. I want to get back to the ADHD, because I don't think people really understand ADHD as this label, because often I encounter people who have ADHD who have incredible powers of concentration. I think there's a sense that ADHD is the inability to concentrate. But actually, you can concentrate for hours. I've heard your TED talk on sand, in which you've lost hours, 8 hours, 9 hours. You've lost meals gazing at one grain of sand. Now, to somebody who doesn't really understand ADHD, they'd say, well, how can you have ADHD and yet spend 8 hours really focused on something?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. And I think what it is you just need to find something that really captures what you authentically love. And then when you find that thing and it's endlessly fascinating to you, you can really, really hyper-focus and fall down a rabbit hole with it all, which is what happened with me in my sand-gazing phase, whatever that was about. That always all happened accidentally as well.
Tell us about the sand gazing, because I was mesmerized by you spoke about it very engagingly for 20 odd minutes, and I discovered things about sand that I would never have known. You talk about large patterns of sand, but really the talk is about the tiny granular nature of sand and how different it is around the world. And you have collections of sand and you speak to sand collectors. How did you get that hyper focus on sand? Why did it happen and what has it given to you?
So probably first I should explain why I did it, so I don't sound too bonkers. So it was after several years of having the proper job that I mentioned earlier, and I'd sort of got a bit lost and I really wanted to go back to being an artist again and a creative, but I'd lost my confidence and I really didn't know how to get there, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do or what I wanted my medium to be. Yeah, I was at a real crossroads. And I started making this Pinterest board, just all the things that I loved when I was little. And interestingly, they were all things like watching sunsets and doing skimmers and collecting shells on the beach and gazing out of an aeroplane window and looking down a microscope at school and all these things that just put me into that space where you know, connect with the environment yourself. And I thought, God, none of these cost any money. You know, the best things in life really are free, aren't they? But then I thought, where am I going next with this? And I didn't want to have a plan. I'd come out of the rat race with strategies and agendas and deadlines. I wanted to go with the flow and see what happened. You hear people talk about follow your heart. And it's like, well, how do you do that when you don't even know where your heart is? So it was a bit of an experiment on myself. It was when I remembered that I loved looking down microscopes, and I used to get in trouble for that because I would be looking down in biology lessons and I would see wonderful patterns. And then I'd be wanting to stay in over my lunch break and do a collage of it and colour it in. And I was told, no, Jenny, take the microscope to the art room and stop doing biology. So I took the microscope to the art room and then started gazing at things. And when I was remembering the things that I loved doing when I was younger, I remembered this, you see, and I thought, oh, I'd love to have gone a bit further with that. So I bought this little microscope for £5.99 that I could click onto the front of my iPhone, and I started just taking photos of things. And then I was Googling around, like, what interesting things could I photograph? And I accidentally stumbled across this image of sand grains under the microscope, and I just thought, no way. Sand doesn't look like that. That's ridiculous. So I put one Facebook post on Facebook and said, if anybody lives near a beach or they're going on holiday, could they whiz me some sand over because I want to have a look? And I only had Morecambe sand to look at. And all this sand started flooding in, and it was like the magic porridge pot, and I couldn't stop it. And it came in, and it was mesmerizing, and the shapes and the colors. And then I got a more powerful microscope and another one. And then somebody asked me to do a TED talk, and then, which I said no to three times, but they said, but what if this inspires somebody else to leave the rat race? So I did it. And then that led to an exhibition. So I had to get an even better microscope. And then, yeah, rest is history.
I heard that this obsession with sand was something that was sort of ingrained in you, that your childhood was surrounded by sand in Abu Dhabi, and now you're surrounded by sand in the northwest of England. It's almost like it was destiny, wasn't it, that you were going to gaze at tiny grains of sand, if that's possible.
Well, was it Steve Jobs that said that life is like joining up the dots backwards? And I wasn't really aware of this at the time, but yeah, I guess it was. I was brought up in the desert. My parents, who are from very working class family in Barrow-in-Furness and Blackpool, and they wanted to escape the poverty trap. And in 1974, they went to this place called Doha because Dad had read about it in his civil engineering magazine. He'd managed to get himself a degree amazingly. But then he realised that the bin men were being paid more than he was. And he looked in his civil engineering magazine, and it promoted this place called Doha that had turquoise sea, white sandy beaches. So we went, which was pretty brave of them. And I was only 3 years old. But we got there and it wasn't really like Barbados. And it was just a desert. And I didn't go to school till I was 8 years old. I think there was a school, but I don't think they could afford to send me. And so, you know, our weekends were spent going into the desert. We used to take the coffee table and turn it upside down and sledge down sand dunes on that. And then just lots and lots of beach combing, I suppose, and making mud pies. And there was one hotel, but we couldn't really afford to go there. But we did go there maybe about once every month or two. Had fish and chips, because you can take the Teesdales out of Blackpool, but you can't take Blackpool out of the Teesdales.
You just said there that you didn't really go to school till you were 8 years old. And that seems to me that it might be quite a profoundly important part of your story, in that, you know, people mostly are at school from the ages of four till eight. The Jesuits famously say, give me the boy until he's seven, I'll give you the man. And what they're sort of referring to there is a didactic form of education in which children come in, they be told rote learning, learning times tables. And it's quite the thing now, actually. I mean, government setting targets for reading and writing and arithmetic. And we think all those things are really important, but they might be slightly suppressing the creative urges that you think are so important. And as a child who's not been at school till you're eight, that surely must have affected how you socialized when you eventually did go to school. I mean, you'd have done so much daydreaming in your own space, quite small family. not having other people around you, your brain is going to be absolutely whirring with ideas. And yet when you get to school, suddenly discover that actually what's valued is not all those thoughts that are in your head, but whether or not you can do quadratic equations. I mean, is that a fair observation?
So I guess I had a lot of time to do daydreaming, and I had a lot of time for my inner cave woman to come out. And whilst I didn't go to a school, my mum had a friend called Jean Maggiore, and five of us used to go to Jean Maggiore's spare room. We were all different ages, and we used to sit on her bed and all of us do different things. So I did do a bit of colouring in. Did some colouring in once. and she would read us stories and things. And then Jean Maggiore got a porter cabin in the desert. We would go out, and there were 12 of us then. So I did have a little bit of a sort of education, but it was very strange. And there was a lot of time for just wandering about. And there weren't that many of the young people about. And there was a 5-year age difference between me and my sister. So I was a bit solitary. I wasn't lonely, but I was solitary, and I was just there with all this nothingness. So I guess it's a big space for your imagination to grow in. Yeah, I had a lot of imaginary friends and animals.
This seems to me that, you know, give me the girl until she is 7 and I will give you Jenny Natouche, who is
52.
Who's now 52, indeed. I want to just go back to something that does keep cropping up, because there's a lot of people who are in the rat race. And, you know, you talk about leaving it and sort of being liberated from it. And I have a lot of sympathy with that, having been there myself. But, you know, the rat race has to have some rats in it, doesn't it? We still have to be able to have those things functioning. So what is it that can be done to make that an altogether healthier environment?
Life's about balance, isn't it? So I think, you know, if you are going to be a workaholic, just try to make the time to have that space, because at the end of the day, we're just a bunch of organisms with egos on a giant rock flying through space. We're only here once. So we've got to play and we will have fun. We don't want to get to our deathbed and think, oh no, I really wish that I'd done a bit more and, you know, enjoyed myself a bit more.
Tech companies sort of do that, don't they? I mean, I remember when tech companies first started up, the sort of the big deal about them was it, you know, if you go and work for them, there's bean bags, there's table football, and there's stuff to play at in the lunch break, you know, and that through play, you'll then come back into the office armed with new ideas that are going to, you know, really help the company. It felt like a bit of a cliche, and it felt perhaps a little bit silly at the time, but there's perhaps more to it, isn't there, than we gave it credit.
Yeah, and I've heard that years ago, actually, was it Google were putting meditation pods into their offices in Silicon Valley. And so there are some good things happening, I think, and how effective they are, I don't really know. But what's interesting is the amount of grown-ups, parents and carers, that when they come and pick their kids up from Escape to Make sessions, they say, I wish we had this for us. We need this for us.
Would you consider making that? Why not? Why not an escape to make for 18 to 80-year-olds?
Well, first we need to get this bit properly off the ground, because we've got lots of different communities around the Lancashire and around the UK that are asking for us to show them how to do Escape to Make and share a learning. But we want to get it really, really right and robust and everything completely ready to scale first up here. And we're about to hopefully move into our first space this summer, because we don't have a space yet. We operate in a pop-up way. It's a pop-up model, which we tried to make work. We're a bit like, so in the past, I think youth centres have sort of, they want the big glamorous building, and then what you do in there is a bit of an afterthought. But we've done it all a bit inside out, which seems to be my way of doing everything accidentally and a bit back to front. And so we've come up with this model, which has shown us what we want from this building. And whether we share it with adults or not, well, that remains to be seen, because, you know, we are sort of going with the flow a bit. But I do think that 11s to 18s need a space that is just theirs. This forgotten age group needs something that's just theirs. So if we start hijacking their space as well, but we are looking at some interesting ideas of who could use the space when the 11s to 18s aren't there. I think we all need this, and we're all getting more and more isolated. We're working from home more. We're shopping from home. A lot of our entertainment is at home. Even talking to our family, we're doing remotely from home, not necessarily in the same buildings because of travel and what have you. Communities and families have become a lot more dispersed. So that is quite isolating and not good for our mental health as well as the young people's mental health. At least we can all remember another way. But what if you couldn't even remember another way? So yeah, I think escape to make for everybody eventually, but let's just start with the age group that need it the most.
So Jenny, what you're doing at the moment, you're doing in Lancaster and Morecambe, but what you're describing is something that you feel needs to be rolled out nationwide. Is this something that, you know, local education authorities can get involved in, just to have a different focus on what it is that they value in children's development? Because at the moment, what appears to be valued is a relatively narrow focus on academic attainment, whereas this wouldn't be awfully difficult to roll out nationwide, wouldn't it? As long as there's the will to coordinate in local communities, the same bakers, the same artists, but taken elsewhere. And the schools can be perfectly positioned to feed into those programs, couldn't they?
Yeah, we are, like I said, we're getting demand for this model from all over the UK. So we're trying to figure it out. We've got lots of interested parties. The chair of our charity was the ex-vice president of Disney. The Said Business School, the Skoll Centre are really interested in what we're doing, as our county council, city council, all sorts of people. And when I've been to meetings with Bill, our chair has taken me to meetings with people all over the place, and they say, why aren't your government paying for this? Because this is going to cut down on mental health problems, on antisocial behaviour problems. It's creating healthier, happier cities, stickier cities where young people feel more connected to their communities and less likely to travel about. But it's just waiting really for the right parties to wake up and see that there's great sense in funding this kind of thing, because the only way we can roll it out is if we can figure out how to make it financially sustainable.
Jenny, I wish you all the very best of luck with that. It's an essential and urgent requirement across the country. Thank you so much for joining us on Inspired Minds.
Thanks so much, Dan. It's just been a joy to talk to you and an amazing opportunity to sort of share the E2M story and how my story connects with that. Thank you.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Jenny Natouche. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.